This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Michelle Fine to discuss pardons, clemency, and the reduction of mass incarceration.
Governor Andrew Cuomo granted Judy Clark, who was convicted of the murder of two policemen and a security guard, clemency after she served 35 years in prison. What's the implication of all of this?
As the country recently honored the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we talk with civil rights attorney David Gespass, former president of the National Lawyers Guild.
David practices both military law and civil rights law. Give a listen to what he says about the pardons of Chelsea Manning and Oscar Lopez Rivera and some of his predictions on what's going to come under Trump.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The United States of America has more individuals behind bars, given its population, than any other country in the world. The policy of mass incarceration is now under challenge. On December 30th of last year, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a broad and bold commitment to grant conditional pardons, clemency, and full pardons to New York State prisoners. Judy Clark, age 67, was one of the recipients and is now being allowed to go before the parole board. She has been in prison for 35 years, sentenced to 75 years to life for her role as the getaway driver in the infamous Brinks robbery in Rockland County, New York, where two policemen and one guard were shot and killed. Our guest today is City University of New York Distinguished Professor Michelle Fine. For 20 years, she taught and conducted research with women and men in prison, most significantly at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, where Judy Clark is behind bars. Professor Fine participated in writing the influential report, Changing Minds, The Impact of College in a Maximum Security Prison for Women. She worked closely with Judy Clark. Michelle Fine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
What did your study show about the impact of a college education on women in prison?
Well, we had a painful and remarkable opportunity. In 1994, Bill Clinton signed the Violent Crime Act, took Pell Grants out of prisons. And so as a consequence, in 1994, there had been 350 college and prison programs, and by 1995, there were 8. Quickly, the women at Bedford Hills resurrected college with some help from outsiders, and we wanted to document the impact of college on the women, their children, the prison environment, recidivism, and therefore the tax burden of recidivism. We put together an incredible what's called participatory research team, half women in prison, half of us from the Graduate Center, worked together over 4 years. And it's really, you can find the study online. It's called Changing Minds, The Impact of College and Prison in a Women's Maximum Security Prison. Simply, we found college and prison reduces recidivism significantly from 30% to 7%, saves tax dollars. But even more than that, transform lives, increases academic expectations of the children, and kind of builds peace and possibility inside prison environments.
You worked with Judy Clark at the Bedford Hills Prison, and she's one of the recipients of Governor Andrew Cuomo's clemency grants. Tell us about her. What got her into prison, and what has she done in the 35 years she's been behind bars? What is she like?
I had the incredible opportunity of meeting and working with Judy over 4 years, and I've certainly stayed in touch since. She is a remarkable woman. She is brilliant, soulful, generous, filled with remorse and a sense of responsibility for the crime for which she has been convicted. but also filled with a sense, with a strong desire, capacity, and history of giving back. Within the prison, she is a leader. She has been at the center of starting the infants program for the children of women in prison. She helped create the summer camp for when the kids come and visit their moms. The moms create a summer camp. She helped initiate the HIV/AIDS program. She's been deeply involved in the puppies program. She was one of the minds creating the college program. I can go on and on. She's a prison chaplain. She studies Kabbalah. She's interested in tikkun olam, healing, that is. Judy Clark is remarkable. She had a 75-to-life sentence. Governor Cuomo, in a bold act, brought that down to 35. Were it not for all of her amazing accomplishments, her case still raises the question of how much punishment is enough. This is a woman whom, obviously, Governor Cuomo recognized her soul, her capacity, her remorse, her sense of responsibility, and the incredible gifts she can offer to us on the outside. He realized that in an hour. It took me maybe an hour and 15 minutes to realize that. She's quite remarkable, but I don't, in some ways, she's a flashpoint for a larger set of issues that we should be discussing around our country's national dependence on prisons and punishment.
Cuomo said when he announced the clemency for her that he actually went to the prison and visited her. And he said, I could look into her soul. And Cuomo, who's not particularly known for great acts of empathy, did something quite remarkable and quite admirable, I thought. And then he made the point about how much punishment is enough. What kind of impact do you think that what he did at great political cost, I think, what kind of impact will that have in New York State and nationally?
So I agree with you. I think Cuomo's position, in particular on Judy Clark, the general clemencies and pardons, but his particular move on Judy Clark was a bold move, in part because he knew he would be under attack immediately. He knew he'd be under attack by correction officer, by police officers throughout the state. I think he was very moved when he met Judy Clark. He said to her, so were you under the influence of drugs? And she said, no, I was under the influence of politics. Right? That's a complicated sentence, and that's a sentence that Judy has thought about for 35 years. She's written about, she's written poetry and letters about and to the families, although she couldn't write directly to the families. I was also taken with Edward O'Grady, the son of one of the murders officers. His comment when he said, I will not lose sleep if Judy Clark is released. Her daughter, Harriet, deserves to have her mother back. She has changed. So I think everybody's really kind of stepped up as mensches. Are we allowed to say mensches on the air?
it's not one of the seven words.
I hope it travels. To raise the large question of how is it possible that we have incarcerated so many people in this country, disproportionately Black and Latino and low income? How is it possible that we give people such long sentences? How is it possible that we keep slapping them with denials of parole when they come up for parole? And how is it possible that we continue to punish them once they leave? I think that's the bold conversation that Governor Cuomo has opened. I do work in schools. I see our commitment to punishment in schools with school-to-prison pipeline, with extensive suspension, with policing in schools. So I think what the governor did with Judy was bold, but I think it's an opening for a national conversation about how much punishment is enough.
And we should mention that Judy was incarcerated for a crime that involved the killing of a police officer, even though it was well established that she was in a car more than half a mile away from the murder. So she was charged with felony murder.
Yeah, but it was a violent crime, compounded by the fact that it was a violent crime against two police officers and a security guard who were both killed. And I think that what Cuomo did in coming face-to-face with a violent crime, they're kind of two categories, nonviolent and violent, but he took it head-on with a violent crime. the implications of that are really extraordinary.
I think that's right. I think the fact that he offered clemency to someone who was in for a violent crime is a bold move. I also think that many people are beginning to question this distinction between violent and nonviolent crimes. A lot of times women are in prison for violent crimes because they're driving the car, because they hid his gun, because they lied to the cops afterwards. Those are all considered felony murder, right? So there are lots of nuances to this, what seems like a very clear distinction between violent and nonviolent. I think a terrible implication of that distinction is when people come before the parole board, and I got to see this when we were doing our work in the prison. Routinely, when women who have been convicted of violent crimes, or men, come up before the parole board, they have been denied parole because of the nature of the crime. Every woman I met at Bedford said, I can't change the nature of the crime, but I am a better mother, a better citizen. I've gotten a college education. I'm in the puppies program. I'm in the domestic violence program. People have to be assessed on their capacity to change, their desire to give back, their willingness to take responsibility. Not on the nature of the crime. We can't change the nature of the original crime, as tragic as they may be.
Judy is a well-educated white woman with substantial political backing. Is it fair for her to get so-called special treatment when so many black and Latino prisoners, whose names we don't know, remain behind bars?
It would be unfair if you and I were only sitting here talking about Judy Clark. The country is in a serious conversation about mass incarceration as the new Jim Crow. The country is in a serious conversation about asking, are we locking up too many black and brown people? Judy Clark, as a white educated woman, should be a flashpoint for us all to say how much punishment is enough. If you look at, I think his name was Breivik, the guy in Norway,
right,
who shot up 77 people a few years ago. He got 20 years in Norway. And people are angry that he is taking college courses at University of Oslo from solitary confinement. And that's because Norway's view of how to deal with criminal issues is to treat people as students. That is, to rehabilitate, to educate, and to prepare them to reenter. That is not our philosophy. Prisons have been used definitely as a racist institution to contain the chances of black and brown people. But Judy Clark should be an opportunity for us to raise up the questions of racism, of violent crime, of bail, of decarcerating Rikers Island, of long sentences, of parole. She is an opportunity for us to ask hard questions.
Norway imprisons one-tenth of the number of people the United States sends away. What is the impact of mass carceration on an American society as opposed to what Norway does?
You know, I think racialized mass incarceration, or what some would call the prison industrial complex, is unfortunately a stain on the soul of our country. And it marks what has now become a kind of, as I said earlier, a national commitment to punishment and incarceration as the answer to poverty, to racism, to lack of opportunities, to mental health issues. Something like 66% of women, and I know the data on women's prisons better than men, I'm sorry, something like two-thirds of those women have mental health conditions. Right. When we emptied our homeless shelters, folks showed up in prison. So right now in low-income communities, the only number you can call for justice is 911. It's not because people trust police so much. It's because police and prisons are the only answer that we have offered to the collateral consequences of inequality gaps and racism and capitalism.
Michelle, with the new administration about to take control, are there concerns that we will see a rise in the use of private prisons? And if so, what do you think that impact will be?
There are so many risks, but yes, that is among them. I think the only good thing I can say these days is that new solidarities are emerging to resist the over-incarceration, the land grabs, the school closings, the kind of retreat from social justice. I'm seeing Muslim young people allied with Native young people, allied with LGBTQ young people, allied with undocumented students, allied with Black Lives Matter. When veterans showed up at Standing Rock, I wasn't the only one who cried with a sense of joy that new solidarities are emerging that are resisting the massive unregulated privatization. We are in for a big fight. Private prisons are among the fights. Trump has talked about resurrecting and strengthening Guantanamo. I think we are in for a big fight, but I think everybody is woke now. Nobody's asleep. And people realize that they've got to act. This weekend will show us how many people are, in fact, enraged and willing to take action.
And just to add to that, I think some of the specifics that we didn't mention about what happens when a prison is privatized, yes, obviously, is profit takes over. So things like health care, even food, everything is parceled out, trying to save money. So who suffers? The inmates.
Right. And the treatment is terrible. There have been deaths. There have been health problems. There have been rapes. There have been, et cetera. But also, there's just no accountability. We don't know how much money is being made. We don't know who is making money. We don't know how many healthcare concerns are present because they're private industries. And certainly, the immigrant community knows this better than we do because those are black holes. We actually don't know what's happening inside those prisons.
Michelle, what forces are involved on either side of this struggle? What kind of pushback has there been in New York State against what Governor Cuomo has done? Can you give us a kind of a lay of the land about what's going on now?
Yeah, my understanding is that the Police Benevolent Association and kind of police officers' unions have been deeply involved in resisting this, I guess some of the families. I understand families' ambivalence, I have to say. I've met many families who have lost a child to murder who are very generous about justice reform, want to meet their child's murderer, want to do solidarity and restorative justice. I understand that. I also understand people wanting revenge. I don't think that's an appropriate or ethical position for the state. People might want her locked up forever since they lost a father. That is not a responsible position for a state to take. That is a totally understandable emotion, even though I wouldn't share it for a family to have. But I worry that I think there are retired police officers. There are certainly correction officers I met at Bedford who said to me, it's time for Judy to go. It would be better for all of us if Judy went. If Judy, the longer Judy stays here, the more the morale of the prison suffers because young women, other women start to say, if Judy can't get out, she's a model prisoner. She's done every program. She's initiated everything. She's good to all of us. She provokes hard conversations about responsibility. If Judy doesn't get out, there's no hope for any of us. So the fact that I have had correction officers say this to me is telling. They didn't have to say that to me. So I think kind of individually, I've had police officers who I know personally, I've had correction officers who I know personally say these long sentences, denials of the parole, they don't satisfy any of our desires for what we want prisons or policing to do.
Can you talk briefly about the so-called school-to-prison pipeline and issues like police in our public schools? And how that's having an impact on the whole system.
Sure. I mean, if we just take New York City as an example, and there's, for listeners, there's wonderful report put out by the New York Civil Liberties Union about policing in New York City schools. It's a rather stunning example. I think it is presently 5,000 police officers in New York City schools, and what are called high-impact schools. And, of course, high-impact schools are blacker, browner, poorer than other schools. These are officers who work for the NYPD. They do not work for the Department of Ed. So what used to be disciplinary issues that any of our children might have encountered or engaged in school become criminal issues quickly. A kid's walking down the hall. I know many of these young people. Kids walking down the hall. A police officer says, "Where's your pass?" Young person might or might not have a pass or show the pass, might or might not get an attitude. Police officer pushes on it a bit. And within a few minutes, what could have been just a disciplinary exchange becomes an arrest. There have been online, again, listeners can go online and find stories where teachers have tried to intervene. A few years ago at Eastside High School, a young woman was going up for a college appointment upstairs. The guard said, "You can't go up." She went up anyway. They grabbed her. They cuffed her. The principal, Mark Fetterman at Eastside, came down and said, "Oh, I'm sorry. There was a mistake. I forgot to tell you she was coming up." They said, "We're going to take her in." He said, "Please don't take her in front of the 6th through 12th graders standing outside. Take her out the back door, and I'll follow you in my car." Another officer took her out the front door. Mark, the principal, went to block the door. He got thrown to the ground by the police, and they were both perp walked in front of this line of 6th through 12th graders. Those stories are insane. None of us sitting in this room, all of us white, would agree to that kind of treatment of our children. And this is what's happening in schools for black and brown kids.
You just can't make these stories up.
Yeah. Michelle, if we might ask you a personal question, how did you get involved in this kind of work?
I've always been involved in social justice struggles, civil rights struggles, anti-war, feminist. I got involved in the prison work because some of the women, Kathy Boudin in particular, were interested in getting a PhD. And I got a call from Bill Lehrer saying, "Would you help my friend Kathy get a PhD?" And I started going in. And that was at the moment when President Clinton pulled the Pell Grants. And then this larger kind of educational crisis emerged. The women and then the administration and a bunch of friends of the women, Thea Jackson in particular, mobilized some presidents of colleges to come in, mostly women's colleges, to step up and offer college. Regina Perugi was the president of Marymount Manhattan. She's just a goddess you might all know about anyway. Then became president of Kingsborough. And then we realized we had to document the impact of college because we could no longer take it for granted. And after that, for 4 years, we worked as a research team every other week, interviewing students and dropouts and college professors and correction officers and women on the outside and their children about the impact of college. And since then, I've been deeply involved with a variety of movements around decarceration, college in prison, closing of Rikers, aggressive policing in the Bronx. Because I started out doing work in public education, and unfortunately those systems are highly stitched together in black and Latino communities, which again will sound absurd to those of you living in white suburban communities. But these systems, including gentrification, policing, and schooling, are deeply, deeply interdependent. So school closings are happening where there's heavy policing, where gentrification is about to occur, and often charter schools are the kind of transitional object. Because I work on what's called circuits of dispossession, the ways in which low-income youth, black and Latino, are being dispossessed from public opportunities, it unfortunately seemed like a natural to get involved with prisons. I should also say that I have a foster son. He's now 40. And when he joined our family, this was in Philly, foster care system was never good, but it wasn't deeply interdependent with sharing data with the criminal justice system. Now they are. All of these systems are data sharing, right? Because it's called aligning the data or, you know, being able to track the same case. So now these systems and these children are just deeply vulnerable to mass incarceration at the juvenile justice or adult levels.
But, you know, there is one change, and that's instead of people kind of on the outside advocating the kind of good reforms we've been talking about, incarcerated people themselves are coming into the leadership of these movements. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, I think there are three, if we're looking for silver linings before the inauguration, I think there are at least three. One is the incredible leadership of formerly incarcerated folks around the country. New York City is just a thrilling space where whether it's Just Leadership or HALA or the Social Justice Institute up at Columbia or College and Community Fellowship, these are all being led by formerly incarcerated adults. And what's stunning about the kind of brilliance they bring to this organizing work is that they understand policy, practice, and life on the ground. They understand vulnerability and violence. You know, I've met lots of folks who say, I'll tell you who shouldn't be let out. Everybody knows who shouldn't be let out. Everybody knows who should be getting mental health support rather than incarceration. We can tell you the consequences of solitary confinement. So there's a kind of thick sense of responsibility and knowledge in that community. And they are organizing with young people. They're working on prison reform. They're working on the Rikers issue. They're working on aggressive policing. They're working on release of older adults. But they're doing it with victims' rights groups. They're doing it with prisoner rights groups. They're not making the distinction between perpetrator and victim that we all make. They know that most people in prison have also been victims of crime, right? So these violent, nonviolent, perpetrator, victim, these are distinctions made from afar. And they also really understand, as I said, policy, but also on the ground, what it's like to live in a community where there's a lot of violence. So they're anyway, there's just a wisdom. The second is, as I said earlier, just new solidarities are emerging. The immigration justice folks are working with the prison justice folks, partly because the private prisons have brought those communities so together. LGBT folks who are over-incarcerated are now working with prison reform. Muslim folks are now working on prison reform. So prison, for better and mostly worse, has so saturated our culture that it's linked to other kinds of institutions and movements. And the third is even Republicans know we have spent too much money on locking people up and it doesn't work. So that I get calls even from conservative Republicans who say, what can we do for and with people on the inside so they're not returning? And actually, college is your cheapest way to lower recidivism rates. So I think there's a set of forces, even though it's not easy to be optimistic these days, there are a set of forces that recognize the deep racism of the criminal justice system, the over-penetration of punishment rather than development, and the fact that we have wasted incredible precious resources locking people up.
Michelle Fine, it's really been a pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. What can people do to help Judy Clark?
So I think there are a couple of things. People should go to Judy Clark's Facebook page to read her poetry, her letters, find out more about her. Don't just write a letter based on what I said. Read her, meet her to the extent that you can. Watch online What I Want My Words to Do for You, a film done by Eve Ensler, where she has women in prison speaking their sense of responsibility and thoughts about their crime. Judy's got a clip there. But you can also write to Governor Cuomo, thanking him for his courage, and write to the parole board, the members of the parole board, hoping that they, too, will exercise the kind of courage and ethics that the governor has shown.
We've put up on our website, lawanddisorder.org, the addresses of both the governor and the parole board.
That's extremely helpful. Thank you all.
Michelle Fine, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, take it easy, Michelle. Thanks.
Yeah.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This year, Martin Luther King Day had a special resonance for many, given its lead-up to the Trump inauguration. That the president-elect engaged in social media attacks on longtime civil rights icon John Lewis prompted a flurry of reactions on Twitter, some especially emotional, given that the timing coincided with MLK Day. As we prepare for a changing of the presidential administration, and as part of our Lawyers You'll Like segments, we talked to longtime civil liberties attorney David Gespass from Birmingham, Alabama. David began his law practice in Washington, D.C. in 1971. A past president of the National Lawyers Guild, he has also served as editor-in-chief of the Guild's scholarly journal, the NLG Review, and was a founder and steering committee member of the Military Law Task Force. His practice includes police misconduct and prisoners' rights litigation. He has been a member of the National Police Accountability Project since its founding in 1999. David has been practicing law in Birmingham, Alabama, since 1978. David Gespass, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We're recording this show the day after we learned that President Obama has pardoned Chelsea Manning, Oscar Lopez Rivera, among others. What are your thoughts on especially these two pardons and what the cases represented?
Well, my first thought is, where has this guy been for the last 8 years? And I would also have to say the fact that he has ignored Leonard Peltier really reflects a lack of understanding of just how important these matters are. That being said, it's quite gratifying that he has remitted Chelsea Manning's sentence, which was obviously far longer than anybody else who had been accused of similar.
35 years.
Yes. I mean, it was like 10 times longer than like the longest other sentence for similar acts.
Yeah, and she's already, when she gets out in May, she'll have served 7 years. So I absolutely agree with you.
And, you know, leaving aside just how seriously she suffered while in custody, the complete failure of the military to be able to address her gender identity issues, and it still remains that what she did, in essence, was reveal some of the criminality of the U.S. Military in the Middle East, and that has never been addressed. Whether or not she violated any laws is, you know, an issue for the court-martial, but why are the perpetrators of these much more serious crimes not brought to account?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
Yeah, this is it is a measure of delayed justice for Chelsea Manning, and it is welcome, but in many ways, I think, too late.
Yeah, you know, David, one of the things she revealed was that Apache helicopter, American soldiers executing 12 people from the air, and then when Iraqi people came to try to rescue them, they killed them too. I think that's what you made reference to when you said nobody was prosecuted from what she revealed, but she was sent to prison for the longest period of time of anybody ever on a whistleblower case.
What was really grotesque about that particular event was not even the fact that they killed, you know, this Reuters reporter, but the utter vulgarity with which the pilots addressed those people, the complete contempt they had. This one poor guy was trying to help out and has children in the car and in a truck with him, and it's like, well, they shouldn't have bring them there. You know, so it is a reflection of what U.S. imperialist war does to who are probably perfectly decent people to begin with, and it turns them into killers and monsters.
I think it's interesting also that Obama has been the harshest commander-in-chief and president with respect to leakers. He's prosecuted more, and certainly the Manning sentence, as you said, was disproportionate to the alleged offense. And David, you especially have been involved in a lot of international cases. What was your response to the release of Oscar Lopez Rivera?
In many ways, similar to my response to Chelsea Manning. I am gratified that Obama did that. On the other hand, it is far too late. Almost all the other Puerto Rican nationalists have been released or received some sort of pardon or sentence mitigation long since. And the fact that he remained in prison was a real stain on the U.S. Criminal system. So it's nice that he's out, and I'm glad for it and really rejoice with the Puerto Rican people about that. But where was this guy 8 years ago?
Yeah, Oscar served, I think, 35 years, almost
right.
Half of his life. He's 74 years old. But he's with us now, and he said through his lawyer, Jan Sussler, that he's ready to get back into the movement and still committed to winning freedom for Puerto Rican people who are listed as a territory, that is, a colony of the United States.
Just to add that what he was really punished for was not the crimes for which he was convicted, but the claims that he was behind killings that he was never even tried for.
David, you've practiced law in Birmingham, Alabama for nearly four decades. Tell us what it's like being a progressive or a radical attorney in the Deep South.
It's kind of interesting in a lot of ways. Clearly, most of the judges are hostile to my political clients and are hostile to the kinds of things that I'm doing. On the other hand, I have generated a lot of respect. One magistrate judge told a U.S. attorney that I'm the conscience of the bar, which is something, by the way, that many people have said about the Lawyers Guild generally. So in that sense, I'm sort of a microcosm of what the role that the Lawyers Guild plays nationally, I think. It is, of course, difficult because when we try cases in civil rights case or whatever, juries are probably more than in many other places antagonistic to my clients and to the exercise of their rights vis-a-vis, for instance, police or prison guards. It is, on some levels, a little bit lonely because there aren't that many people who agree with me. On the other hand, I think that people down here who, with our politics, make a difference that they wouldn't make in places like New York or San Francisco because there are so few. And now in my dotage, I am really hoping that there are a couple of young lawyers around that I'm working with that I'm more interested in my succession than I am my own practice at this point.
When you talk about the hostility down there, it reminded me that Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, also like you, a member of the Alabama Bar, he was a prosecutor there for 20 years,
yeah.
And then a senator, and now he's going to be the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. And have you ever come across him in your professional practice? And secondly, what do you think he's going to do as Attorney General?
I have not dealt with Sessions at all because by the time I was down here, he was a U.S. attorney in the South, and I'm Northern District. And then he launched his political career by being rejected for a judicial nomination. So he's been a senator for most of the time that I've been down here. I have friends that went to college with him and said that back then he disliked the fact that there were people that would talk to African-American staff in the lunchroom as sort of equals. He thought it was inappropriate for them to do that. Now, whether or not he has changed since those days is, I suppose, an open question, although I haven't seen any great evidence of such change. And frankly, I think the allegations of racism from 20 years ago are less significant than his more recent declarations of politics and more that are at least as threatening as what he said back in his misbegotten youth. As his, now that he's in his misbegotten old age, he is now attacking immigrants. He is on pretty much the wrong side of every significant issue that's going to come before the Justice Department.
David, you organized what was truly an incredible annual Guild convention in Birmingham a couple of years after 9/11, and John Lewis was there. What were your reactions this week as we honored Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to Trump's derogatory comments about John Lewis, our civil rights icon, during Martin Luther King weekend?
It just seems like every time Trump says something outrageous that you say he can't possibly say anything worse, he manages to do it. It was really both remarkable and revolting that he would accuse John Lewis, of all people, of being all talk and no action. For somebody who, you know, grew up in the lap of luxury, to criticize Lewis, who grew up in segregated Black Belt South, one of 10 children, and who nearly died in fighting for civil rights for African Americans, it's really repugnant. It's up there with some of the other outrageous things that he has said, and it's just once I'd like to see him apologize for something stupid that he says. And he seems, one, incapable of apologizing, and two, incapable of not responding to any criticism that comes his way. And one hopes that sooner or later this is going to be something that people are going to recognize sufficiently so that he is a one-term president.
David, you knew Chokwe Lumumba, and you wrote about his death. Can you tell our listeners who he was and how you know him?
I met him just a couple of times, actually, a demonstration here in Washington, one or two other times. He was from Detroit, moved down to Jackson, Mississippi, to engage in political work as an African nationalist, and became mayor of Jackson. His son now, by the way, is running for mayor. He ran after Chokwe died a few years ago, fairly suddenly and quite unexpectedly, I think. But he was quite remarkable in his ability, one, to express revolutionary politics in a way that people really related to and really responded to, as evidenced by the fact that he was elected mayor. And as evidenced by the fact that when he proposed some tax, it was really voted on overwhelmingly in favor of it because people really trusted that the taxes would be used for their benefit. He also had a pretty amazing ability to relate to people with whom he disagreed. I was just in Jackson last month for the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference and had an opportunity there to meet his son, Anton, and his daughter, and as well as people from this organization that is has spun out of his mayoralty and his campaign that is now supporting Anton for mayor. His impact and the effect he had on people that knew him well was really quite remarkable. There was this really phenomenal kind of mixing of admiration and love, admiration for what he stood for and what he was able to accomplish, and love for him personally as just a decent and warm human being that you find very rarely in anywhere. And too often, I think, people on the political left separate out politics from human interaction, and that was something that he just was able to combine in amazing ways.
In our remaining minutes, David, we wanted to ask, as best you can, for some of your predictions about the state of our civil rights and our civil liberties as we head into the Trump administration. What do you think are some of the real cuts that we face that will imperil those rights?
Well, I think it's quite clear that we are going to be facing more and more privatization. That's not unique to this administration, but I think it's going to increase, and that is going to result, along with the planned increase in military force, which I find completely dumbfounding, given that we're still spending more than the next seven countries combined on the military, is going to be big reductions in benefits for the poorest people in the country. In terms of civil liberties, the Trump's response to John Lewis, I think, is indicative of the danger we face, which is that if he is going to respond to every criticism as if it were a threat to be dealt with and attacked and perhaps prosecuted, our ability to resist and to speak freely is going to be under attack in a way that has probably not been the case since the 1950s and the McCarthy period. David Ryan, who is a Guild lawyer that actually stayed in the Guild through the 50s back in D.C., said he thought McCarthy period was the closest we came to fascism in the United States. And while I would not say that Donald Trump is a fascist because I don't think he has any ideology beyond his own ego, I think that the views and the trajectory that he reflects really create that kind of a threat. And it's up to people who defend democracy and human rights to fight back very strongly against that. We have done so in the past. I am reasonably confident that we will do so in the future, but I am also very apprehensive about what the next few years are going to bring. I actually think the next 2 years are particularly significant because not only are we going to have a Republican president, we're going to have a majority Supreme Court that is going to be Republican nominations, and we now have a Republican Congress. It would be nice if at least some of that were changed. That, of course, requires that Democrats develop some backbone. That, too, is something that I am apprehensive is not going to happen.
David, how can people learn more about you, your practice, and read some of your fine commentary on a number of issues?
Then go to our firm website, which is, it's just Guest Pass and Johnson, not an ampersand, but andjohnson.com. A lot of the stuff that I've written we have there. And I suppose go to nlg.org as well, and some of the things that I've written for the Guild Practitioner and the NLG Review are there in the archives. And I just had yesterday a little piece I did on Selma Samuels, who was one of the three Guild lawyers remaining after the 1950s in Washington, who just died at the age of 103. It's on the Guild blog right now.
David, full disclosure, you were my boss for 3 years when I was at the National Lawyers Guild, and I just want to end by saying the kind words that you used to describe Chokwe Lumumba, I would also apply to you. Thank you for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, David.
Well, thank you. I'm flattered and don't know that I deserve it.
You take it easy.
Take care. Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof. 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio.
KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online.
Thanks to all our affiliates. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.